This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
Welcome to Dishy Mix. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. And on today's show, I have a very, very special guest, a dream come true guest for me personally. It's Alvin Toffler. And you know that I've been talking about him coming on the show. And today is the exciting day that you're going to get to meet him. He's a futurist, of course, an author of many amazing books. They just keep getting better. And an advisor to companies and governments worldwide on advances in economics, technology, and social change. And I know that that's something that you love as much as I do. Alvin and his beautiful wife, Heidi, of 59 years, have written, of course, the very well-known book, Future Shock, The Third Wave, Power Shift, over 10 books now, and his latest, Revolutionary Wealth, which you're really going to like a lot of the things that Alvin's talking about, because you are on the cutting edge of exactly where he says the future is going. So let's get Alvin on the show and welcome him. Welcome, Mr. Toffler.
Hello there.
It's so great to have you here. Thank you so much for doing the show. For people who might be a little bit younger and didn't kind of grow up in the Future Shock world, Alvin, could you just go through a brief overview of some of the highlights of your work and the distinctions that you've made in our collective conscious about the evolution of our future?
Well, the book that had the biggest bang early on was Future Shock. That was published a long time ago now. What it did was introduce, I think, to the public. It was a smash bestseller all over the world. And what it did was introduce the idea that change is accelerating, that we're not going to be moving slowly through the future, but that, in fact, we're going to see faster and faster developments. And it was also the place where I talked about the consequences of that, the difficulties that people may face in a life in which you may move more often to new places, new homes, than before. A place where you may change jobs more frequently. A place where human relationships, many of them, become temporary, and so on. So that's what Future Shock was about, and it obviously talked to the moment, and people just kept saying, "You're describing my life," and I think that. That's why I think it turned out to be a tremendous success as a book.
Yeah, you hit a collective chord. We were all feeling that acceleration, and you named it. And The Third Wave was really a big book, too, and one that was so... I mean, Al Gore may take credit for inventing the Internet, but you predicted it. Tell us about that.
Yes, that was the second big book that we did. And what that did was try to put in perspective today's tremendous changes and point out that we really, if we look back over human history, we've got essentially two forms of existence prior to the current one. The first one was we were hunter and gatherers. Maybe there's three if I count that. We were hunter and gatherers. And then somebody discovered, probably a woman, 10,000 years ago, discovered that you could actually plant things and make things grow. And out of that came the long, long history of the human race based on survival by agriculture. And that continued to be the central way of life for people all over the world until the Industrial Revolution came. And roughly speaking, you could there are different dates given to that, but I would say 1650, something like that. You begin to have the very earliest moves toward the beginnings of that. And then you have in Britain the actual development of an industrial economy. And you have all these people moving off the farms into the cities. And with that comes a change in the nature of the family structure, the number of kids you're going to have, the location, and the terrible work conditions and circumstances. And then what we did in the third wave was say, hey, but wait a minute, that's not the future. That's what economists tell poor countries, you've got to industrialize. But in fact, starting earlier, and we wrote this in the third wave, there was a third wave of change coming, and that was based on knowledge. And that is where we are now, and that is where we are going. And that, again, had all of our books from that point on were international books. But that one had a very special impact that Heidi and I didn't know about until quite recently. And you might find that...
What was it? What was the impact?
What it was this. The book was published in 1980. In 1983, the Chinese government... We knew none of this. We knew none of this. We visited China at about that time, but nobody told us anything. Had no idea until much, much later. But it turns out that in 1983, the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party had a big meeting in October, and in that meeting, somebody said, "You got to read this book." And we also made Heidi produced. With the help of the Japanese television NHK system, NHK, an hour-long picture, television show, based on the third wave. And what happened was, without our knowing it, the book went to the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, and they had a big argument about it. And somebody said, "You got to read this book." And as a result of that, we were subsequently, only a few years ago, told every kid in China had a copy of that book. And recently, I find it very flattering, but also slightly amusing, that I am on a list of the 50 people who had the greatest, 50 foreigners, who they say have had the greatest impact on China. It's a joke. But the book did have a big, big impact on what's happening in China today. And the guy who led that was also the guy who stood up for the kids at Tiananmen Square, and he died just a couple of years ago.
Who was that? Was that Zhao Ziyang? Was that the premier?
Yeah, he was. Uh-huh. He was at one time.
Yeah, and he was the Ministry of Communism.
They just set him aside, and he spent the last 10 or 15 years just alone in his house in Beijing.
Oh, so sad.
Well, anyway, so that we had that history. And we only found out about a couple of years after it actually, a little bit of it we found out a couple of years later, and what I said about the impact I just learned in the last couple of years.
In your latest book, Revolutionary Wealth, one of the things that you talk about is the Great Circle, which is that China started out as the superpower and in the 1500s, and that you think that it's come back full circle and that China is about to be the next superpower again.
Well, we did write about that, and clearly it's moving in that direction. But the reality is that the world is not just going to be made up of nation states. Even now, of course, it has international corporations and international NGOs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Did you read that book, Jennifer Government?
No.
Oh, you'd like that. That's a book about what if multinational corporations were really the superpowers and it wasn't countries, it was corporations.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of satirical. It's like future satire.
Uh-huh.
You'd like it.
What's the title?
It's called Jennifer Government.
Jennifer?
Yeah, like the girl's name.
The girl's name?
Yeah.
Jennifer Government.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, I'll get it.
Yeah, you'll have to check it out. I can send you my copy.
Okay, great.
I'll autograph it for you, Alvin.
Oh, terrific.
I didn't write it, though.
Okay.
So do you think that there's a connection between the fact that every child in China had a copy of the third wave and knew about the move to the knowledge economy, and now that's why they're becoming, in your esteem, the next superpower?
Well, I think
that'd be tidy.
I think it had an impact, but of course there are many, many things going on at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think it's too much to claim that, we made this all happen. We didn't. We wrote a book about very importantly did the television version of the book. That was Heidi. Heidi did that in collaboration with NHK, the Japanese the main Japanese television company. And that was an adventure for us all over the world. But that, I think, was probably the most impactful in the China situation. Now, I don't know that, I don't think things are going to move in a straight line just because China's been going, it has to solve its internal problems, which are greater than I think we tend to recognize.
What do you think their biggest, greatest internal problems are?
Well, there's a long list. I mean, you've got environmental problems and so forth, but you also have a lot of unreported outside China.
Yeah.
And maybe outside, maybe inside China as well. Unreported risings, people, violent protests and so forth. And according to the Chinese police themselves, they report something on the order of 75,000 to 85,000 of these a year. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And that's why the crowning word of the current government there is essentially keep it smooth, keep it smooth, keep it smooth. They use a different term, but that's what they're talking about. Because they do have tremendous internal complications as a result of rapid change, which is what we wrote about in Future Shock.
Exactly. Alvin, I really want to get to what I saw as the two big pieces to this knowledge economy that you talked about in your latest book, Revolutionary Wealth. One was this rise of, and maybe not even rise of the prosumer, but this acknowledgement of the prosumer's contribution to the economy, combined with what you called, and you love to coin terms, I know, you called it K-tools. You meant knowledge tools, this coming to the fore of all of these very evolved ways that we're capturing knowledge and then sharing knowledge in the way that it's this limitless wealth building opportunity, and the companies and the countries that are ahead on the curve of prosumer contribution and knowledge, contribution of knowledge, are the ones that are gaining ground faster. Can you go into a little more detail on that? I just wanted to set the stage for it and try to stitch it together a bit.
Are we ready?
Yeah, I'm ready for you.
Okay.
We're all ready for you.
All right. Well, obviously, ever since the Future Shock, we've been writing about the rise of knowledge as a fundamental component of economics. And that, in fact, we're moving away from the industrial order that we still have remnants of, but basically we're moving, as we said earlier, toward a knowledge-based economy. And that changes everything in the social order and in the politics, although it is not properly recognized in politics, and even in our American politics, and less so in other countries, and so on. But this third wave of change, which is a historical event, for me and for Heidi and our readers, this is the future, and we're talking now about futures that arrive more rapidly than ever before. And so, I mean, I'm not about to say that what we're doing is creating a civilization that's going to last 10,000 years. But my guess is we will, at least for the next 50 years, that's what we're going to be living with. And that is countries and economies that are going to be more and more dependent on knowledge, which is intangible. And that knocks all kinds of props out from traditional economics. And in fact, the really disturbing thing to me about the recent election is the infrequency with which even our current president, who is surely smart and I think understands some of this, with very little reference to the fact that we're moving beyond the industrial age. And so what you hear the politicians talking about today is, we need more jobs. We need. We're talking about infrastructure, for example, putting up huge sums of money for infrastructure, which is great. It was wonderful, but you almost hear nothing about a computer. And the image I have is we have more traditional roads, more traditional this, more traditional that. And in fact, the infrastructure is going to be dramatically different 50 years from now or 20 years from now, and so forth. but the political order here in this country doesn't recognize publicly any of this stuff. Another example is the emphasis on manufacturing. Now, most people don't know, but in Revolutionary Wealth, we point out that manufacturing, which was the source and the key to the economy up until some point. When was that? When did that stop being the central factor in the economy? And the answer is roughly 1956.
Yeah, it was earlier than I would have imagined.
Yes. From 56 on, services and knowledge functions were the biggest part, two-thirds, roughly speaking, of the economy. You don't hear that at all. It's as though none of this existed, and as though this were just the same as a traditional industrial economy, which it's not. And so I find it disappointing, as I say, to hear the political talk continue to go on and on and on, as though we were moving further into a factory-based economy, which we're not.
You have a really fun analogy. I call it the road race to the 21st century economy. And we're going to go to a break. And when we come back, I want you to take us on that super highway to the future and tell us who's going to win and who's going to fall off on the side of the road in a heap of flaming, mildering mess. So we'll go for a break. I have to thank my sponsors. And we'll come back and we'll talk to Alvin Toffler, futurist and author of his latest book, Revolutionary Wealth. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Listen to Coaching the Life Coach, business and marketing strategies for growth of transformational practices, your guide in the 21st century marketplace on personallifemedia.com.
We're back with Alvin Toffler. And Alvin, I promised everyone that you would talk about this road race, this story that you tell about who the fast cars and the slow cars are, because it really does point out what's wrong with the system today. And then I want to move to some little hopeful things that you offer as possibilities of the way we can move in the future. So tell us, who are the fastest and slowest cars on the proverbial road?
What you have, things are happening in our society, every society, but particularly now and in our society. Things are happening at different speeds. Economists who are desperately trying to, you know, fix this crisis that we have pay zero attention, as far as for all practical purposes, to the fact that different parts of the economy and different parts of the social system operate at different speeds. For example, imagine that you're looking down the highway, there's a cop with a radar gun, and along comes a car going at 100 miles an hour. And let's say that car is just a symbol of business. Businesses have to operate rapidly, more and more rapidly, because of competition, not only traditional competition from your own country, but from all over the world. And so what you see is an acceleration taking place among businesses, companies, and indeed in production as well. Then, so let's just count the first car going down the road that the cop is watching that is moving at 100 miles an hour. It's a symbol of business. What's going fast after that? Another car comes along, and it's just crowded with people in it. And those people are, in effect, symbols of NGOs. NGOs are growing at an extremely rapid pace, multiplying, spreading, and so on.
Now, make sure that people know what an NGO is.
Oh, a non-governmental organization.
Organization. Like what? What are good examples of NGOs?
Oh, well, when you want one, there are hundreds of them. And when you have to stop and think. Go ahead. You can probably answer that question quickly.
Well, I always think not-for-profits are NGOs.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. Yeah,
exactly. Not-for-profits that are trying to change the world, but they're doing often philanthropic work.
But it also can be other kinds of institutions. But the point is that they are non-governmental, and they're not ordinary businesses. They may be operating for purposes other than profit. Then you have, and so that car that's growing very rapidly. So if business is moving at 100 miles an hour, the NGO, the growth of NGOs and the increasing significance of NGOs, let's say that's going 90 miles an hour. Then you start looking at other institutions in the society. You're looking at government agencies. Have you tried to deal with one lately?
Yeah, I try not to. No one tries to, Alvin, do they?
They're the slowest thing you can imagine.
Yeah, why do we put up with that?
So we have, in effect, business moving at 100 miles an hour, NGOs growing and moving at 90 miles an hour, and governments plodding along at 25 miles an hour. Then we get to education.
The worst.
And that's doing maybe 10 miles an hour in change. And then you have other players in the system as well. Then you come down to finance and the crisis that we're in. One of the reasons given for this crisis is precisely the fact, and is frequently overlooked. We wrote some stuff about this recently, and that is, you have a desynchronization here as well, and you've got new technologies coming into. First of all, you had a bunch of people from Silicon Valley, otherwise known as quants, turning up on Wall Street 10, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And out of that came the invention of new kinds of financial instruments and new kinds of deals that could be cut and so forth and so on. And that was all done very rapidly, and not only here, but spread around the world. On the other hand, what happened to regulation and watching the store? The answer is very little. And it moved at, instead of 100 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour, or if that. And, of course, you also had political presidencies that reduced regulation on the financial structure. So what you had was new technologies, new markets outside the U.S., new techniques, new forms of investment, and basically nobody keeping up with that change. None of the regulatory forces were able to keep up with that change. So one of the crises, one of the reasons for the crisis we're having has to do with time and timing. And there's almost no attention paid to that by economists. And then the other part, which is almost as important and perhaps even more so, but is also ignored, is the increase and the accelerated increase of complexity. Now, it used to be there are certain kinds of deals that you could make, but as I said a moment ago, given the computer and given the speed up of everything, you could now turn out all kinds of new forms of investment that people even didn't understand. I spent 10 and a half, 12 hours on an airplane flying to Korea not so long ago, and a guy sitting next to me, what do you do? I'm in finance, and we do this and that, and we sell these instruments. He said, but just between us, I don't understand how they work. So what you have are two forces at work that are very important and are not adequately understood. Acceleration, the desynchronization of activities, and growing complexity at the same time.
I want to go back to the last car on the road, education.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You've said that industrial America, built on fossil fuels, is now rushing to build an advanced, knowledge-based economy, but saddled with a legacy system. That's our education system, essentially our Achilles heel.
Yeah. What you have, is, as I say, is a system which is going faster and faster and faster and is no longer an industrial society. You have a school system, however, which remains in the past. And all the discussions about what kinds of changes should be made, the question that should be asked, which I never hear anybody ask, is when the kids, little kids, grow up, what is this world going to look like? And if you look at the education system and the history of it in the United States, back in the 1800s, there was a tremendous political struggle that went on for 20 or 50 years between those who said we should have public education and others who said no. And then the guys who said, let's have it, decided and won that. And we created a very effective education system that was geared to the rise of industrialism. That's why your schools are factories. where you do the same stuff over and over again, and you come, you have to come on time. You know what's important about not going late to school? What's important is industrialism. Back before the Industrial Revolution in the United States, the kids and the family worked in the fields. If somebody, if Uncle Charlie showed up a little late, or the kids showed up late, so Mary would, you know, pluck a few more plants. Didn't matter. But once you had industrial production, you had assembly lines. If you show up late for the assembly line, you hold up maybe 1,000 people downstream from you. So you had to show up on time. Everything had to be exact. And what you had in the factory, you're producing multiple copies, and in the schools you're hearing the same thing, multiple stories again and again and again.
So what's the solution? What do you think are the basic tenets of a knowledge-based economy education system, a system that can support the future of our economy?
Well, so the first step is to ask ourselves, what are some of the characteristics of the future that these kids are going to live with? And again, one of these is precisely what I'm talking about. Their life is going to move at a faster pace. They're online. They're not taking a big heavy textbooks around anymore. I was just having a conversation about that with Heidi, my wife, yesterday. And by the time you've learned something, it may be obsolete. So what you need to do is learn to learn. And there's just a whole lot of we have to take the factory apart. But when I hear discussions of the need for improvement in education, you can't improve the education system. You got to kill it. And I'm not the guy who actually said that. He said it, I thought, too many decades late, but he said it. And that's our friend who started Microsoft. What we're going to need is, the key thing, you said, what's it going to be like? The answer is we should not have uniform schools. We should have multiple different kinds of schools, different times of day, different times of the evening, different types of topics, all kinds of variation, because that's the kind of world we're going to be living in and do live in already, highly diverse, with lots and lots of things going on at the same time, and fewer and fewer people working on an assembly line, except our children. They are on an assembly line.
Yeah, they feel like they are, too. I can tell you that the worlds are colliding for the kids today, where they live in this information and knowledge economy and the access to the internet and all of the media and the freedom of world travel, yet they're stuffed into these little warrens of schools. And they know it.
School factories, yeah. And, you know, it's not the teacher's fault. My sister's a teacher, but she's locked in that system like everybody else. And This is going to explode, and it's not just in the U.S. It's all over the world. The same problem at different speeds. You know, different countries are moving at different speeds, but this is the direction it's going to have to take. We're going to have to blow up the existing system. We also did a column a couple of months ago with toying with the idea of keeping the schools open, but not for kids, for the elderly. To relearn what needs to be relearned in order to be at home.
Vital.
In this new kind of society.
Yeah, that's right, because they do get disenfranchised when the technology moves so fast beyond them.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. Yeah, everything's becoming operationalized on the internet, and if you're not comfortable with that, it's difficult to go get your driver's license renewed and things like that now.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to switch gears a little bit because I want to make sure I get a couple. I have two more kind of burning questions for you before the end of the show. And the first one is a listener question, a Dishy Mix fan question for you. He knew you were coming on the show. His name is David LaPlante, and he runs a very smart advertising agency out of Reno, Nevada, called 12 Horses. And here is his question. He actually had three for you, but that's too many. I'm only giving you one. So I'm going to read it, and then you'll just take this all in. Science fiction has told us future wars to be fought by computers and nanotechnology. However, as much as that sci-fi is coming true, it is perhaps not a greater chance that our wars, particularly wars that are rooted in cultural difference and inequity, are better fought by today's and tomorrow's brand marketers. That is to say, would we have been better off spending $1 billion dropping culture bombs, putting 50-inch high-def TVs in every home, hooking up every household to broadband internet, distributing MacBooks to every Iraqi citizen, hiring defense contractors like Disney, DreamWorks, and Pixar to make war creative in the form of information entertainment that transforms a culture? Are Britney Spears, Paris Hilton, Simon Cowell, and Zac Efron our most tactical weapons? I can't help but think of the transformation of Japan and the Western influence in Tokyo and the command of the brand when I contemplate this.
Wow.
That's a good one, huh?
That is a good one.
Take it where you want to, Alvin. Whatever you want to do with it. You just go.
That is a good one. Well, first, as we know, the outside world is finding out more and more about all of this. And it's not going to stay bottled up forever. And we're going to see changes on that level. And we're not. And those of us who can't keep up, and that includes me, are going to find ourselves increasingly left behind. And I think that that what you're really saying is it's been called soft power, that we should be instead of fighting, literally fighting wars, we should be fighting cultural wars,
mm-hmm.
And thereby hopefully avoiding actual wars. And there's quite a bit of discussion of that, as you probably know, in Washington, under different names and titles and so on. But the bureaucracies stay the same. And so I think this is it's a long way before our government actually comes to understand and make use of even simplified versions of what you're talking about.
Yeah, so if they're the third fastest car, they need to take something from the playbook of the first fastest car, which is corporations, their brands, their products, the ideals of their society.
They don't want to. Companies are moving so fast that they dread dealing with the government, if for no other reason. I mean, they may want to buy contracts, of course, but to deal with the government, to deal with the bureaucracy, which is a tremendous second wave industrial phenomenon, the complexity of the bureaucracy, the growth. We've got this agency for fighting terrorism. Well, it's a giant bureaucracy. The people they're fighting are not bureaucrats. They're small groups of terrorists. So why would we expect to be able to do something about it using that form of organization? I think that we're going to have to invent a whole lot of new, not just new businesses, but also new hospitals, new schools, new everything. And that's the challenge of the years from now until, say, the middle of the century.
I want to ask you a last question, and it's more of a personal question. You've told me that your greatest achievement is being married for 59 years. I can't wait till next year when it can be 60, because that's an amazing number too. Heidi's been your partner in the work that you do, and this is your greatest achievement. Tell us about your relationship with your wife and your life partner and your business partner and how you've made that work for so many years.
Well, it's funny. We're writing that story in our next book. The story goes this way. In 1948, which is ancient history, there was an election, presidential election coming up. I was a college kid. And I went with a small group of blacks and whites from New York, where we came from, down to North Carolina to help register black voters. This was not a very popular thing to do in North Carolina at the time. But in any event, we did do some of that. We slept in black homes, and we knocked on a lot of doors and encouraged people to register to vote. And then I suddenly discovered that there's a weekend coming. You know what? I could go home for the weekend and then come back. And so I headed home. And I came to, I was a student at NYU. And NYU, for those of you who know New York, has a park in front of it, which is in effect its campus. And I found myself checking in, saying, oh, I'll see some of my buddies. And I crossed the park, and there was a girl from a class that I knew. And sitting next to her was a gorgeous Hollywood-like blonde, and that was Heidi.
She is so beautiful. And still, that, yeah.
And from that day, we have been one. And she is smarter than I am about most things, if not everything.
That's pretty common with a husband and wife, I've heard.
Now,
it's the same in our family.
She is a fabulous lady. She has strong opinions. We work together. I write. I do the actual wordsmithing, but the words and the ideas behind them are jointly ours. And she is she's filled with ideas, and she's very strong-willed. She knows an enormous amount about things I don't know anything about. She knows medicine inside out. And her life has been, it's really interesting. She wanted to be a doctor. And she was told in her youth, you can't be a doctor. First of all, you're poor. And second of all, you're female. Well, what Heidi has done is make herself, she's not a doctor. But we have one library here at home, which is entirely filled with medical texts, which she has read from cover to cover. And everybody we know, who when they go to the doctor, come to Heidi for a second opinion. And she is a frustrated doctor, is what she is. And she's been just incredible.
Well, she's obviously taking good care of you. You're 81 this year, right?
Well, also, no line of our books goes past Heidi. She's got to prove it. What happens? I reach a rough point, and then I come back and I say, what's the next thing we need to include in this chapter, or take out, or what have you. So we're very, very close. But we're close on everything, and it's just been a wonderful. Let's put it this way: it's been a wonderful 60 years, with one horrifying part. And that is, we lost our daughter.
Oh, my God.
She died of illness.
Was she your only child?
Our only child, yes.
Oh, yeah. That's heartbreaking.
But I'm grateful for the day I met Heidi.
What is it about what you two do that creates that level of intimacy?
Well, we argue constantly.
Do you? So it's not friction-free.
No.
Uh-huh.
No, argument is good.
Yeah.
Given some rules of the game,
What are those rules?
Well, they're not formalized here. I can't list them for you, but we know we love each other. We tell each other that 10 times a day.
Yeah.
We kiss each other.
Nice.
We're in love. But that doesn't mean we can't disagree.
Yeah.
And indeed we do. And we'll disagree about some article on politics we read in the paper, or we'll disagree about what to have for dinner.
You want to have a hamburger, and she says you need to eat fish.
No, it's the other way around.
Oh, is it? That's funny. Well, I can't wait to read your new book. I have to say, how long did it take you to write Revolutionary Wealth? It is a densely packed book. It's a tome.
It took 11 years.
Yeah, I felt like it took me almost that long to read it. It's a lot. There's a lot there. I mean, on so many different levels. You're talking about world economics. You're talking about the infrastructure of countries. You're talking about cultural shifts. I mean, it's like such an amazing amalgam of your life learning and the access that you've had to so many amazing people and the information that you're pulling in and putting together. I'm not surprised it took 11 years. How good did it feel when you shipped that manuscript off? Did you do a little jig?
You can imagine.
Oh, my God. That really was a life work right there. Just that one book, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
And, of course, it incorporates, the ideas that we had previously.
Yes, you pulled it all in. You pulled it all in together. Yeah, if you're going to read any one book, that's probably it's the book to read now. I can't wait to read your book. Your new book is more like a memoir or a life story or an autobiography,
it'll probably
right?
Probably be a memoir.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds terrific.
We've had some really incredible adventures that we would never have anticipated in our youth. I mean, around the world and places we've been and the people we've met, and it's just been a very remarkable, unusual.
Future Shock opened up the doors of the world for you.
Yes, that did happen.
And you took advantage of it. You know, one of the things that I would like to have you write about in the memoir, if you don't have this on your chart already, here's a request from me. And that is that you've met so many amazing people, you know, from Queen Beatrix to King Juan Carlos of Spain to, I mean, world leaders, economic leaders, you know, just the most amazing people all your life. And not all of us get the opportunity to even meet one of those luminaries, those dignitaries, those thought leaders, but sometimes we do. And it would be really great for you to talk about not just who you met, but when you met them, how did you create the highest and best opportunity for both of you in that meeting?
Well, like, I'm going to leave you with one sentence.
Yeah, that'd be good. Perfect.
One sentence. This was in Belgium, and we met the king and queen. We were taken in. We walked in. I came up to him. He approached me. He put his arms around me, and he said, "Love your wife." That was the entire conversation.
You've done that very well. Alvin, thank you so much for being on Dishy Mix. It's really been a pleasure and an honor to have time to talk to you today. And thanks for the amazing work that you and Heidi have given to the world.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about it.
It's my pleasure.
Be good.
All right. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. I hope you've enjoyed your time with Alvin, and I look forward to connecting with you next week. Have a great day.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.